Hello and welcome to the Majlis, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's current affairs podcast focusing on Central Asia. I'm Mohammed Tahir, the host of the Majlis and Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's media manager for South and Central Asia here in Washington, D.C. Corruption has never been a distant story for people in Kyrgyzstan, but the past couple of days, this might be one of the most popular subject people are talking about in the country. And this has to do with the bombshell investigation produced in collaboration between Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, OCCRP, and Club Media. It's an eye-opening report revealing the depth and scope of the problem, and the revelation is particularly damning to two highly powerful families, Matraimovs and Abdulkadirs. Most of the revelation came from the treasure trove of the documents shared with journalists by a man. His own background is kinda murky and is murdered earlier this month in Istanbul. His name is Erkan Saymati, an ethnic Uyghur of Chinese origin. Though he's murdered, but Jane is out of the bottle. A growing number of people are talking about it and taking the streets demanding accountability. Though the cause for the latest outcry is this investigation, but experts say the report merely scratches the surface and the history of corruption is by no means limited to the current administration. So we are here to discuss some of the details of the report and also weigh in on some of the broader corruption-related questions in Kyrgyzstan. To discuss this, I'm joined by Ilya Lozovsky, Managing Editor of Organized Crime Corruption Reporting Project, also called OCCRP. Bakit Bashimov is joining us, who's the former Kyrgyz diplomat and currently a lecturer at the Northeastern University in Boston. Bruce Panier, editor of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, Central Asia blog, Kishlog OOZ, is with us from Prague. Thank you, colleagues, for joining us today. So I think the latest investigation is still developing in a complicated story. We might not be able to cover all aspects of it, but it's available on Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, and OCCRP's websites, and anyone can go and read it in full details. However, let's decode some of the details. Ilya, in a couple of paragraphs, walk us through some of the major points of the report.
Sure. So as you said, this is a really complicated story and a long story. It's a long read. There's a lot of detail, but you can boil it down. As you said, obviously, it's a story about corruption. And what we learned from Saymati, from the documents he provided, from a lot of additional reporting that we've done to confirm what he said, is basically what looks like an alliance between two families. One, as you said, is the Abdulkadirs. They're this sort of secretive family about whom not much has been known. They have a company network around the world that owns real estate. But what we found is that they essentially run an underground cargo and trading empire that begins in China, goes through Kyrgyzstan, and then continues into other Central Asian countries and even into Russia. And what makes this empire, it's a logistics bringing cargo companies. But what makes them so profitable and successful is that they have sort of an alliance with the customs service, which allows them through various methods to avoid transaction fees, customs fees, processing delays, all kinds of different sort of services, quote unquote, that customs officials provide to trucks belonging to the Abdulkadir family. And, you know, we essentially describe a situation where several of the customs terminals between China and Kyrgyzstan and then between Kyrgyzstan and Uzbekistan are essentially almost private facilities for Abdulkadir related companies. And if you're a competitor, you're going to find it very hard to compete. This has enabled them to make an enormous fortune. And of course, with payoffs happening to customs and to Rai Matraimov, the former deputy head of the customs service and a very powerful man in Kyrgyzstan. So once you have all this profit from your illicit underground cargo empire, what do you do with it? You have to launder it. And this is where Saymati came in, and this is why he knew so much about this and why he was able to describe this to us and to prove it with documents, because he was instrumental in getting this money out of Kyrgyzstan for, on behalf of the Abdulkadir family and others. And we show how he used wire transfers using bogus reasons, fake loan contracts with Abdulkadir companies, cash couriers who physically moved cash across the border, and other methods to essentially launder what figure we landed on is over 700 million. The truth could be much higher, but there's, you know, certain documents that prove some portions of this and certain other information that's come out from the Kyrgyz financial police. So I think it's probably more, but, you know, we just stick with a conservative number, which is what we used, although it's still, I think, a rather shocking one, of course, considering, you know, that Kyrgyzstan is one of the poorest countries in the world.
Right. Yeah. In terms of those numbers, $700 million. I think the chief financial police officer put the number way higher, like close to $1 billion. It's really a big number considering a small poor country in Central Asia. So about this guy who provided all these documents, Saimati, who is this?
So Saimati is sort of, we describe him, the short, brief description for him is he was a professional money launderer. He is a Uyghur who comes from the Xinjiang region in China. He moved to the southern Kyrgyz city of Osh as a teenager, I think when he was maybe 17 or 18. He sort of began working in a local market, which is right on the Uzbek border. So he would have become quite familiar with, import and export and how these bazaars work. And he became an expert in moving money to China on behalf of some customers, which may have included some of the vendors in the market because they buy goods abroad, and then they send cash out and then they get the goods in to sell. So he became experienced with that. And he was approached by Habibullah Abdulkadir, the head of this family, who asked him, can you help us teach us how to move money? And at first he was just going to show them how to do it. This is in his words, this part of the story. But then they just hired him to do it for them in exchange for a cut of the profit. So over about 5 years, he used these various methods, largely wire transfers in the name of himself, his wife, and a company that he owned, but also, as I mentioned, cash couriers to move this sort of proceeds of this Abdulkadir cargo empire into other Central Asian countries, into, around the world, basically. And we also show in a separate side story that I should have mentioned earlier, the Abdulkadir family that's running this empire and the Matraimov family, this customs chief's family, we found that they had a joint real estate project in Dubai that's worth several millions of dollars there. The wife of Matraimov owns some land there, and they're jointly with the Abdulkadir family developing a building on one of those plots. Mm-hmm. This is the first time we've shown an official business partnership between those two families, though, of course, what Saimati told us, because he was running this money laundering portion of this operation the whole time, is that, obviously in Kyrgyzstan, mm-hmm. they are also jointly corruptly making all this money. But Saimati was really best placed to know these things. And he had a falling out eventually with the Abdulkadir family after doing this for them for about 5 years. And he told a story of being beaten up and held at gunpoint in a hotel room in Osh. They took his passport away from him. And we couldn't really confirm, what was the origin of this falling out. Saimati says they basically, I knew too much and they went after me. They wanted always for me to be the fall guy for all this money moving. Other sources say that there may be other reasons. We can't confirm this. We do know that they had a falling out. We know that a criminal case was launched against him, which he felt was a trumped up charge that, was engineered by his former bosses and now enemies. So he ended up fleeing through Tajikistan into Turkey, ended up in Istanbul, which is where we found him. And he had been living there for the last 2 years, sort of no longer working for the Abdulkadir, but still continuing his money moving operations for other clients. And so RFERL did an initial investigation into this earlier this year, which this investigation substantially expands on. And that investigation, after that aired, Saimati received a threatening phone call from a powerful criminal figure, which is another side story of our project you can read. And so that part also sort of explains the pressure he was under. It's true that powerful people who he had worked for and whose business he knew wanted him to be silenced and did not want him to talk to mm-hmm. reporters anymore. And tragically, just as we were accelerating the writing and editing process and still the reporting process for this package, due to another death that occurred, Saimati himself was murdered in Istanbul on the night of November 10th, I believe. Mm-hmm. And so for the following 2 weeks, we basically, it's a large team, as you said, RFERL, OCCRP, and CLOP, journalists, reporters, editors, writers, everybody working together to put this together as fast as possible, because we were also threatened during the course of this reporting, and we needed to get it out as soon as possible, especially since Saimati was tragically killed.
Thank you, Ilyam. Also, Beckett and Bruce, please feel free to join the discussion and ask any question you might have in mind to Ilyam. Yeah, at this point of the discussion, I'm kind of trying to read Ilyam's brain on this report, but definitely going to expand it shortly. So just to continue on my point.
I have a question to Ilyam. First of all, I would like to thank him for a very interesting observation, and he added very interesting ideas to existing investigation materials. My first question is, do you have plans to continue this investigation?
I really can't talk about future plans right now just because we still have some safety concerns. So I just can't talk about that.
Yeah, I can see. And I would like just to provide some comments about complexities of this investigation, and I agree with Ilya. And the second about, trends in a public opinion regarding this investigation. But first, of course, we understand it's extremely complex. even if I ask a question, how to explain that these Uyghur people from China, given what kind of control over them imposed by the Chinese government, frequently and freely traveled from this place to Central Asian countries, to Turkey, Russia, and United Arab Emirates. I think it is a very interesting thing. Secondly, about in a public opinion in Kyrgyzstan, I discovered that the following things. The first, the investigation has clearly shown that a vast underground cargo empire run by Abdulkadir's a secretive Uyghur clan together with Reinbek Matraimov systematically funneled massive bribes to the high officials of a government during several years. Secondly, they developed, as investigators just outlined, a prearranged, highly organized system in which officials at various levels, from those working in the terminals all the way to their bosses, received portions of these proceeds. Thirdly, the buy-off method appeared to be highly effective for them, lucrative for high officials of a government, and disastrous for the country. And during the investigation, Kyrgyz law enforcement did not respond to repeated requests for comment. And I can make a preliminary conclusion that the Kyrgyz authorities' reaction to this investigation is non-constructive, that indirectly indicates their possible involvement in that large-scale corruption.
Okay, let's see where it goes. But Bakit, some of the loopholes that you were talking about, the way these guys survived in Kyrgyzstan doing all these things, you know, you were part of the government in the highest positions in Kyrgyzstan. I mean, explain us, please, how possibly those people survived for so long doing what all these stuff that they were doing there.
That's why I said that I assume that high officials of Kyrgyzstan, Kyrgyz authorities, former and current, they were involved in this corruption. Because in my opinion, without protection of Kyrgyz authorities, it would be impossible to organize and run this criminal business for many years.
Bruce, any thoughts from you so far? Any question to Ilya? I have lots of them, but I don't like to dominate the discussion here.
I know that Ilya doesn't want to talk about some of this stuff, but just to echo what Bakit was saying just a second ago, that, you know, this was my problem when the initial report came out, and as information, because of course I'm working here, so I hear as they were investigating it, bits and pieces of where they're headed with this. Jan Bekov was the governor of Osh province in the south when a lot of this was going on, and as Bakit said, when you are in that position, you hear things and you know things because you're well connected all over the place. So this is why, you know, I can see where, you know, Atambayev certainly is president when a lot of this was going on. There should be some questions that he needs to answer. But the current president, this is also bad news for him, too, because he was from right down in this area. And, you know, to say that I didn't know that any of this was going on, I don't think anyone's going to believe that at all. I certainly wouldn't believe that. The consequences of this are going to be very, very far reaching in Kyrgyzstan and really in the end, not even in Kyrgyzstan, because if you remember, we did the podcast a couple of years ago, right, when Kyrgyzstan and Kazakhstan were having problems, right, and the Kazakhstan closed the border because all of a sudden they found this contraband goods that weren't supposed to be crossing the border. And they said, you know, some of this stuff is coming from China. While the tensions were between Atambayev and Kazakh authorities, they kept the border closed. And then they seemed to wash their hands of, you know, just kind of forget the whole thing had happened. And the border was open. And it, presumably the same goods just started crossing into Kazakhstan again. So you wonder how far this network went. You know, like I said, it seems like Jay and Bekov surely must have known of something like this.
Yeah, earlier you kind of hinted if part of this was happening in Osh, it cannot happen without some connection to Uzbekistan. What sort of connection was that?
Well, in fact, there was a very consistent connection to Uzbekistan because there's a very large market in Uzbekistan called Abu Sahi. It's in Tashkent. It's, you know, Uzbekistan is a much larger country than Kyrgyzstan. So that's a big market with a large influence and a large demand for goods. And this is where a lot of the Abdulkadir's cargo, Chinese cargo, went through Kyrgyzstan to this market called Abu Sahi. And the company network that the Abdulkadirs run is also called Abu Sahi. So it's sort of connected. And Saimati told a story that we relate in our investigation that we couldn't confirm, that actually Habibullah Abdulkadir was the founder of a market in Tashkent called Abu Sahi. Now, I don't think it's clear whether it was the same one. I mean, there's probably a lot of facilities sort of all on top of each other.
Ilya, just to clarify here, but there was also Abu Sahi owned by the son-in-law of the former president, I believe.
The husband of Lola Karimova, yes.
Right.
So anyway, that market is one of the main destinations of these goods that are coming from China and using various tricks in customs to get cheaply, quickly through Kyrgyzstan and into Uzbekistan. And then the money had to flow back. You know, these 700 million or more that SMIT sent out for the Abdulkadirs, a lot of those profits came in the form of cash earned at a so-called cash desk at the Abu Sahi market. And so actually we heard that the money was smuggled back into Kyrgyzstan inside the spare tires of trucks. And then the money would arrive in the sort of Abdulkadir owned facility near Karasu. And then that's where Saimati would sort of come in and take over and take that money, you know, get it deposited into a bank. He didn't do the actual depositing, but he sort of came and made sure it all happened. And then he was then responsible for sending it on. And some portion of that would represent money for customs, for Matraimov. Most of it would be Abdulkadir money, earnings, and that would go abroad into various investments. So Uzbekistan is definitely a central part of this, but not only, because a lot of these goods also were, even though some of them were declared as heading to Uzbekistan, in fact, the Chinese goods would be unloaded near the border, I believe also near Karasu, and then the empty trucks would continue on to Uzbekistan as if the goods were still inside, the transit goods with the transit papers. But in fact, the goods were now in Kyrgyzstan, and then they would either be sold in Kyrgyzstan or then they would be smuggled further on into Kazakhstan, Russia, wherever, which are much more lucrative markets. So this was definitely a very transnational situation. It's obviously, you know, the whole thing with customs is it touches more than one country, as Bruce rightly said.
Yeah, during the former president of Uzbekistan, it was so difficult to cross that border, but apparently it was not difficult for those trucks. So interesting. And also, how was response so far, Ilya, to this report from the authorities?
Well, as I think the ambassador mentioned, there hasn't been much of a response. You know, the customs people have just flatly denied there is no smuggling. The story does not correspond to reality, kind of the usual boilerplate, although they have no response, of course, to the documents that we provided and all the other evidence we have. The president's office, I think, has mostly just denied any connection between President Jeenbekov and the Abdulkadir family. We have a photo in the story of Habibullah Abdulkadir attending the inauguration of President Jeenbekov, and that seems to have been a touchy subject for them because that's what they responded to out of all of this. There was a commission formed, I believe, in the parliament to investigate this, or it may have been a pre-existing commission that was in response to Saimati's death that maybe is now taking up this issue. And actually, Raim Matraimov's brother, Iskander, who is a member of parliament, was on that commission to investigate Saimati's death, which I think is kind of a remarkable thing. And in the wake of our publication, he stepped aside. He's saying, you know, he wanted to avoid an appearance of conflict of interest. Finally, you know, I think a really exciting thing, you know, a new thing is a protest that took place on Monday in response to the publication. And, you know, it wasn't enormous, but it was a lot of young people who used the occasion to sort of call for, you know, an end to corruption and also for journalists to be protected against threats from organized criminal groups, which I think is an important part of this whole equation, too.
Thank you, Ilya. So, as I said earlier, talking about corruption, content of this report is merely a tip of iceberg, and this is true for the entire region, not only Kyrgyzstan. We know this from the Place Central Asia Occupies an annual anti-corruption report. So what else is there to talk about corruption in the country? Let's continue the Majlis podcast talking about these and many other questions very shortly. First, let me recap the debate that today on the Majlis podcast, I'm joined by Ilya Lazowski, Managing Editor of Organized Crime Corruption Reporting Project, OCCRP, Ambassador Bakit Beshimov, former Kyrgyz diplomat and currently a lecturer at the Northeastern University in Boston, Bruce Panier, Editor of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's Central Asia blog, Kishlok Owozi. I'm Mohamed Tahir, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's Media Manager in Washington, D.C., and we are discussing corruption in Kyrgyzstan in the light of the recent May major investigative report. Coming to you, Ambassador, so talking about the Matrayimovs, his name is widely discussed, I guess, in relations to a number of questionable things in Kyrgyzstan, but I didn't know much about the Abdulkadiris so far. As I said, the content of this investigation merely touches the surface of much bigger picture. So what's the bigger picture here when it comes to corruption in Kyrgyzstan?
First of all, I would like to outline that thanks to the new generation of Kyrgyzstan, who organized a highly effective meeting and protest in the country, investigation materials became number one reading in Kyrgyzstan and bombshell in the entire region. And that's why we are trying to understand why Kyrgyz authorities are so offensive and so non-constructive. Regarding this man, he symbolizes corruption in the country. And that's why outrage people in Kyrgyzstan, especially new generation, were asking very legitimate questions. For instance, if presidents who proclaim himself as anti-corruption leader keep silence, putting his finger on his predecessor. In his last press conference, he asked journalists to provide facts. The credible facts were delivered to his attention. And what in response? Silence. Does he understand that his silence and the continuation of this corruption undermine the rule of law and his legitimacy? And after people, young people asking why, despite the credible investigation and strong demand of the public, Rahimbek Matrayimov, a former top Kyrgyz customs official, is still essentially untouchable. And people asking if the prime minister and the speaker of parliament are not the recipients of the bribes from this criminal syndicate, why they are not taking adequate measures. And it tells about large-scale corruption and about the possible involvement of this regime in this corruption.
Bruce, let me bring you on here. I mean, it's, as we are talking about, I mean, this investigation, a very important document, it reveals lots of inside information when it comes to corruption. But again, corruption is not limited to this. I mean, it's a bigger issue in Central Asia. So when you look into the map, where do you see, in which areas you see this is more relevant? Of course, because of the Matrayimov's connection to customs, we understand that might be a problematic area. Where else we should look into to find signs of corruption in Kyrgyzstan?
Well, I mean, let's face it, they got the Bishkek TETS, the thermal power plant investigation is still going on too, and that was funded by China. You know, before we get too far from Matrayimov, I just want to add something that Bakit was mentioning too, that, you know, he was thrown out as deputy customs chief when Atambayev was in, and after Jan Bekov got in, a court ruled that was an unjust decision and actually ordered him to be reinstated in that position, which he did not take up. But presumably there was some process that involved an investigation into what his doings, dealings were when he was the deputy customs chief, which absolved him of all the accusations against him. And you know, like I said, in a very strange move, the judiciary ordered him to be reinstated to a post which is really appointed by the government. And the judiciary doesn't have any real decision on naming officials to that. So, I mean, you know, the whole thing stinks. Now, this does point to corruption in customs services in general. And that's, I think, if you ask anybody in any Central Asian country, what are the most corrupt agencies, government agencies, state agencies, whatever, in your country, the customs service is always way up there. And this just points out that it's systemic, practically. And yet, this is a region that wants to be part of Belt and Road and other trade corridors at the same time. This is exactly the kind of thing that works against them. So, you know, this is something that they have to tackle. Now, as far as Kyrgyzstan and where else can you find corruption, like I said, we saw with the Chinese loan, you know, for the thermal power plant that 100 million out of 384 million went missing, you know, somewhere around in that figure. And this seems to happen a lot with any major project. Anytime you have any big project that's going on, you can almost count on the fact that some of the money is going to get taken by somebody. And it's not just Kyrgyzstan's problem, certainly. I mean, this happens all the Central Asian countries and countries outside Central Asia, without a doubt. Yeah. But it goes to the top all the time. There's top placed officials are on the take for this kind of stuff. Otherwise, they wouldn't be able to do it. Lower level officials can't carry this kind of stuff out without some kind of nod and consent from people that are further up there. So it's a bombshell. And you know, in Kyrgyzstan's case, it's more of a bombshell because they have parliamentary elections next year. And the top two parties are already collapsing. They're talking about lowering the threshold for the number of percentage of votes you need to get a seat. And, you know, like I said, the Social Democratic Party of Kyrgyzstan is in shambles, and it's got the most seats in parliament. And Respublika Tajurt has effectively split, and the former leader of Respublika, you know, again, he's not even going to, he says he's out of politics now. Yeah. So the parliamentary seats are wide open, and amount of ammunition that parties have now to assail, like the established parties, like the STPK, you know, I mean, corruption is going to be a huge factor in campaigning Kyrgyzstan once the campaigning starts, which really will start in just a couple of months.
Bruce, please hold your thoughts. I definitely like to follow up on this question in terms of the long-term implications of the report. But before that, Bakit, maybe you could jump in here. I mean, we are talking about this $1 billion being smuggled out illegally from Kyrgyzstan. I mean, your analysis apart, I mean, as someone who worked in Kyrgyzstan in a higher positions, how $1 billion can be smuggled out of the country? How is that even possible?
Only through direct involvement of president of a country, prime minister of a country, key members of a government, including the head of a customs service and minister of internal affairs, and so on. Without that, to create, to run this kind of criminal business, large-scale criminal, is impossible.
But again, we are talking about not only the period under current administration. I mean, these guys were active for a long time. Ilya, maybe if you would like to jump in over.
I can tell you something. It started during Akaya's time in the 90s. I remember a time when the head of customs union, he brought to this service entire family members. And afterward, it's continued during Bakiyev's times. And it's flourished and developed into this large-scale corruption during Atambayev's rule. And just Jeenbekov, he continues this kind of business, and you can assume that he benefits. I can tell you about the recent facts. For instance, today, one member of a parliament who is loyal to a current regime, he said that how we can blame Matraimo for this, because as a main sponsor of the last parliamentarian election. And until now, we don't know how Jeenbekov got $24 million for his election. Wow, and we can assume who are among the main sponsors of his campaign.
I don't know how we can confirm these numbers, but again, Kyrgyzstan is a very vibrant society. People talk about lots of things. But Ilya, you have made lots of investigation about lots of countries. I mean, talking about this huge amount of money being funneled out of the country from Kyrgyzstan, is there anything that surprised you, that shocked you when you were investigating this report?
I mean, certainly the amount, you know, $700 million is a huge amount. I mean, we at OCCRP have done other investigations about money laundering and sort of underground financial flows that were bigger than this. You know, we have some of the Russian laundromats, the Azerbaijani laundromat, where the numbers were in the many billions. But that's Russia. You know, that's Azerbaijan, which has oil. Kyrgyzstan is just astonishing that this amount of profit can be wrung out of this country. And of course, you know, the people who suffer are the citizens and the people of Kyrgyzstan, whose rule of law is being undermined and who are being deprived of revenue that should be public, you know, for their benefit of everyone in Kyrgyzstan. So that was shocking. Of course, the murder was very shocking. You know, we had spoken to Saymati in Istanbul 2 weeks prior, and there were certainly security concerns. You know, he was worried. He had told us about the threats he had received, but certainly to have someone gunned down in public, you know, he was drinking tea in a cafe. It was pretty shocking. And that's not even all, because he had some of his cash couriers had been killed in previous weeks. So to me, I think it's the impunity that you see here. I mean, these people built this whole thing over many years. And I think the value, you know, the big value of the investigation is we're proving something that has been talked about. You know, Matraimov has a popular nickname in Kyrgyzstan. They call him Raim Million because of his wealth. And so there's a lot of things that people talk about, and it's sort of in the air, you know, but we're proving it with documents. We're proving it with, you know, rigorous reporting. And I find it shocking that these systems are just continue to exist year after year without anyone taking some action. Yeah. But of course, it's because it's in their interest not to, probably.
Yeah.
very. But I don't want to speculate.
Yeah, very impressive reporting. And this is the report is available in full, both in Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, and OCCRP's websites for those who are interested. But as I said at the beginning, so we like to conclude the discussion in just 1 or 2 minutes, but very shortly, Bruce, the broader kind of implications, the long-term implications of what we're talking about in terms of this specific corruption report. I mean, how do you see this is going to have an impact going forward to, I don't know, in shaping up some local realities, local elections? What kind of implication, long-term implication, you see, Bruce, this investigation is having in Kyrgyzstan?
You know, sadly, I think the biggest implications it'll have will be on the political changes that are going to necessarily happen. I think that a lot of people are going to take the fall for this one, because the public is not going to be satisfied until they see someone being held up for justice here. In the end, I'm not sure it will change the way the Customs Service does business. And if Abdul Qadir is removed, then there are 50 other people who would probably be willing to take his place, and they'll just come up with a more elaborate scheme. That's not to discourage people from trying to root this out and put an end to it once and for all, but it is deep in the system after all these years, and it's going to be hard to get rid of the corruption angle. You can get the people responsible for it right now, but like I said, there's other people that are willing to step into their shoes, and so the biggest problem I see is Jan Bekavot. You know, he's going to have a hard time. He got 4 more years in office, and good luck if he makes it all that time, because he's going to have to really prove that somehow that he had no involvement in this at all. Otherwise, I think the public's going to turn on him.
Bakit and Ilya, where your eyes will be going forward after this report, after all this discussion that Kyrgyzstan is having in terms of corruption? So where your eyes will be, Bakit, let's start with you.
This investigation already created political crisis in Kyrgyzstan. We see that from one side, it's outrage of a public and number of people who are just demanding investigation and asking to bring these people, Rainbek Matrimov, to justice increasing. From another side, we can see silence and very offensive attitude. State-run TV and media highlighting protests of young people as a Western plot, and the notorious newspaper Daily Number today issued an article, Americans prepare a coup in Kyrgyzstan. It means that already tension in the country is strengthening, and that's why some kind of effective, let's say, more sound response from the president of the country and government are needed. But these young people who organized this highly effective protest, they created a lot of hope. And I do believe that they will strengthen their online campaign. They will disseminate these materials about corruption. They will create collaboration with the international partners and ask the governments of these countries and their partners in these countries to investigate these people, investigate their investments in these countries, and so on. That's why I do believe that it is positive. It's very difficult because the government already started to put pressure on some protesters. But I do believe that the Kyrgyz public is today more oriented, more positively.
Okay.
About the near future of the country.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Ilya, so last point from you. As Bakit was saying, like, there are some newspaper articles are emerging saying that this report was part of the coup. I believe your intention was not a coup in Kyrgyzstan. So what is the best outcome you expect to see happening as a result of this report?
We certainly don't have outcomes like coups in mind. We do not favor any political side over any other. You know, we just go where the reporting and especially the documents take us. But certainly, you know, we are not disinterested in this. The whole point of our organization is to educate the public about organized crime and corruption and how, you know, powerful people in their countries are not being held accountable. And so accountability really, I think, is our main hope that, you know, there are investigations, that whoever is found legally to be responsible is brought to justice, and that people you know, they would create that demand and expectation among people, not just in Kyrgyzstan, but everywhere else we work, to fight corruption and to, you know, sort of push for systems that will work to reduce the ability of officials to get away with these kinds of schemes. Right. So if people, you know, if that resonates with people, that's all we can hope for.
Thank you. With this, unfortunately, we have to end the discussion here. Thank you very much for your great work, Ilya Lazuski, Managing Editor of Organized Crime Corruption Reporting Project, OCCR. RP, Bakit Bashimov, former Kyrgyz diplomat and currently a lecturer at the Northeastern University in Boston, Bruce Panier, editor of Radio for Europe, the Liberty Central Asia blog, Kishlok Owazi. Thank you, colleagues, for your time and task today.
Thanks very much.
Thank you. And this is from me, Mohammed Tahir, host of the Majlis podcast here in Washington, D.C. Until next week, bye-bye.